raindrops are falling on my head. And just like the guy whose feet are too big for his bed.
Hey, hey, it's raining. It's unbelievable.
Would you like it to rain a little harder?
No, this is fine.
How about bigger drops?
No, this is fine. I don't believe it. This is fantastic. It's just like Noah's Ark.
Oh, God. Maybe that's what you were saying to yourself this morning, driving around in all that rain. You know, when I was coming to work and I saw that rainwater gushing down into the gutters, I really wanted to just pull over, grab my travel mug and start bailing and scooping up all that water. Because really, after all our yearning for the rain, it seems criminal that so much of it is now washing away into the ocean. So, short of the travel mug, what could we do to capture this water? Here to give us some ideas, Andy Lipkis. He's founder and president of Tree People, a nonprofit environmental group. Hi there.
Hey, it's great to be here.
Okay, so we're not going to get up and, you know, use our mugs to scoop up all the water, but what could we be doing? It seems just, it's so frustrating to see all the water just washing away after we needed it so much.
We can do a lot, and we can do a lot starting with little steps and build to big steps to actually build LA's new and next water supply. So right away, you could actually put buckets out.
Literally just put buckets out.
Yeah, because rainwater is so great for plants and they have really been needing it. But the large bucket would be trash can. But you can actually go to things like Home Depot and other hardware stores. A lot of them are carrying rain barrels. So that's a 50-gallon device you can hook right up to a downspout and then you capture that. But it's really a thimble. So you start... It's also a starter drug for rainwater harvesting. Uh-huh. People get a taste and they think, oh no, I need 30 of these, not just one. But
you don't have 30 gutters. How do you do that?
No, you can actually chain them. You know, you can chain them together with a hose or a 2-inch hose. But you can also begin to change your garden to actually capture the water as it's running off the roof. It's called building a rain garden, and it can be as simple as redirecting your gutter, which now flows to the street, it's now legal to do this, to redirect it into your garden where you could capture it.
How do you do that?
Well, we're actually, Tree People actually has been holding workshops for several years, training people how to do this. And, you know, one of the things you want to do is put a cork in the bucket, right? So all the water we're capturing runs away. We need to put a cork in the bucket. The other way our water runs away is how much we spend on watering our lawns and landscapes we don't need in that form. And so we train people how to take their lawns out. And it can be as simple as laying out cardboard mulch and putting mulch on top and no hard labor, but you
so
can
you
shut
to,
off your
you
sprinklers.
You don't have to dig it.
No. And what I did, not at all. What I did in my own home in Venice is with just one other friend in 2 days, we laid the mulch out, redirected the downspout from our drain and put a berm around the outside edge of the lawn. So the lawn holds a couple thousand gallons mm-hmm. and it soaks right in. And now I'm growing fruit trees and vegetables and all that instead. But so if you go to Tree People's website, you can see what to do. And by the way, anybody who attends our workshops gets the discount at DWP and MWD are offering huge discounts, $75 off on a rain barrel now. So they can cost you, instead of $95 to $150, it only costs you $10-$20 out of
pocket.
Well,
see, I thought that public officials wanted to discourage us from collecting large amounts of water because they can attract mosquitoes, which can then spread West Nile virus.
It's a concern, but they're not trying to dissuade us anymore. There's ways to safely harvest and hold and store water. And rainwater has to become a part of our local water supply. It currently isn't. Los Angeles throws away 3.8 billion gallons for every inch of rainfall in Los Angeles. So that's according to the city of Los Angeles. Some people say, well, it's maybe half that. Either way, it's a lot.
That's a lot.
So last year, on the driest year in recorded history, we threw away at least 12 billion gallons of water that, had we captured it, would have been about 3,500 gallons per person in Los Angeles, of the 4 million of us. And there's a way to do it. So the rain barrel is a thimble, but some of my neighbors have bought larger tanks, and there are actually very elegant tanks now available that you can put in to hold 1,000 gallons, 5,000, 10,000 gallons. In work, Tree People has been engaged in this for 20 years after seeing what Australia did to survive their massive drought.
So it's called the Millennium Drought.
The Millennium Drought.
It lasted 12 years.
12 years long. And it nearly took the country down, but they responded really well, kind of like we did 30 years ago in conserving, but they took it much deeper because the drought got so bad. The local government agencies, water agencies, first invested in educating people on how to capture water, save water, how to reduce their water use, put in incentives like they discounted the cisterns so people could buy them easily. And they did it by the millions. So in the city in Australia with the climate most like ours, it's the other Mediterranean city there, just like our climate, 45% of the single family homes now have cisterns. They got them cheap, they installed them, and then it happened. So 45% there, but Sydney, Melbourne, Brisbane, all have 30% of the homes now have these tanks.
So they use the tanks for their drinking water?
They use the tanks. In cities, they're allowed to use it for irrigation, for toilet flushing, for laundry.
So that's non-potable.
Non-potable, but it's the major use of the water. What happened is they were able to drop their water use in Brisbane from 83 gallons per person per day to 33. So we're at 123 now.
Which is really good for
most
cities.
It's a massive drop. And the power of adding the rain tanks is it gave people their own water bank account, water that they saw, and they changed how they spent it. Because, you know, you could see the fear spreading around the state in the last weeks. And once you know you have your water, you spend it wisely.
Yeah.
And when you can see how you're spending it. And so not only did they save the water during the drought, but it locked in that behavior change. So now it only returned to 40 gallons per person per day in their use. And they've got abundant water for gardens, for everything they need for a healthy city.
Now, what could city officials here be doing to encourage us to do that?
So we're on the pathway here, which is great. So the laws have begun to change. Department of Water and Power wants to encourage you to harvest rainwater where they used to say no, as you said. They are actually engaged in a very serious, fast study now to see how much rainwater can be part of the local water supply and how to build that. Today, water is only 11% of our local rain is part of 11% of our water supply. We import 89% at a huge cost. And from most of the cost is on energy to pump water to bring it here. And so they're looking with us and other agencies, the Watershed Council, the county, at how we could invest the money locally to create jobs and capture 30 to 50% of our water locally. It's
and
a new day.
And that's doable. That's not a fantasy number?
No, I mean, their first modeling of what water could do would be as much as 30% of our local supply. We'll see what happens when the plan gets totally practical. But the opportunity actually right now could be to accelerate it with a federal response and a state response. You know, we are not just in a short-term drought. This drought might last another month. It might last a year or 10.
Or this could be the way
but
it is.
We could invest now. It is going to be the long-term. And we could invest now in the short-term answer and the long together and save money, build a smart water grid system.
All right. Andy Lifkis, founder and president of Tree People, thank you for coming in. And check out your website, right? Treepeople.org.
.org.
Yeah. Okay. For
thank you.
Water saving ideas.
Stay tuned.
At a White House press conference yesterday, President Obama struck an unusual personal note. While talking about meetings he had recently with teenagers in inner city Chicago, he said this.
I explained to them that when I was their age, I was a lot like them. I didn't have a dad in the house. And I was angry about it, even though I didn't necessarily realize it at the time. I made bad choices. I got high without always thinking about the harm that it could do. I didn't always take school as seriously as I should have. I made excuses. Sometimes I sold myself short.
The president was announcing a new program called My Brother's Keeper to help young Black and Hispanic men succeed. The initiative will look at what's being done to boost the chances of minority men going to college, staying out of prison, and avoiding violence, and then build on those efforts. Some say My Brother's Keeper represents a big shift for the president from being reluctant to talk about race to bringing it on head on. Elahi Izadi writes for the National Journal, and her latest story is called Why Now is the Time for Obama to Address Race in America. Welcome to Press Play.
Thanks for having me.
Well, tell us about this program, My Brother's Keeper. It's explicitly not a government program.
That's right. The president made that very clear yesterday. And essentially, it's an initiative in which the federal government has brought together private sector entities, so businesses, as well as charitable foundations, to fund initiatives, programs, strategies that have been proven to work. And aiming basically the objectives that you stated at the top of the intro there. Mm-hmm. Now, these entities have pledged an additional $200 million of investment on top of $150 million that they've already put in to this initiative. Mm-hmm. The federal government will be involved to the point that the president has basically directed his agencies to look through and see what policies that are already enacted or what can be done from his vantage point to essentially allow more opportunity for young boys and men of color.
All right. And he has been criticized by several civil rights leaders and intellectuals, including the Congressional Black Caucus, for not doing enough to help other African Americans. And, did he deserve that criticism?
Well, that criticism was a lot more pronounced and vocal, especially during his first term. I'm thinking of when the Congressional Black Caucus was very vocal in wanting the president to do more to address Black unemployment specifically. It became muted toward the election, and even now the criticism is somewhat muted, more quiet, private criticism. There are those who believe that the president, as the first African-American president of the United States, has a duty to address these issues head on. I spoke with a number of members of the Congressional Black Caucus yesterday up here on Capitol Hill, and one of them noted to me that this president, he feels, has been the furthest away from addressing race head-on than any other in the past quarter century. Hmm. But in my piece, I discuss how his unique presidency of being a trailblazer enables him and also limits what he can do when discussing race.
And why does it limit him?
On the one hand, he's facing some of this criticism from within the Black community, intellectuals, civil rights leaders. But on the other hand, he's facing criticism and does every time he addresses race head on from the right and conservatives, that by highlighting race and talking about race, that he's being divisive, that he's not being a uniter and being president of all America. And one quote that really stuck out during his first term was President Obama, to all of the criticism he was receiving from Black leaders, was that I'm the president of all America, not just Black America. And that was the message ahead of his reelection campaign. But now he seems to be more willing to go out there, speak more at length, with nuance, very personal, and also back up those words with action.
Yeah. And then he struck a very different tone talking about Trayvon Martin.
That's right.
Very personal tone where he, and I think that also, correct me if I'm wrong, marked a shift in
exactly
how he was willing to talk about race.
Yeah, and I think that's absolutely right. During his first term, when the Trayvon Martin killing became a national story, he mentioned that if I had a son, he would look like Trayvon, and that spurred a lot of criticism. Now, after the George Zimmerman verdict, he went out there and made a point to speak at length about what the Zimmerman verdict meant for Black America, and he did it in a way that no other public official, public intellectual could do and articulate. And this My Brother's Keeper initiative ties into the remarks he made after the Zimmerman verdict, because at that point he mentioned that we need to do more for our young boys and men of color. And I'm not talking about another government program. I'm not talking about turning this into a partisan issue. And he made it very, very clear yesterday. He wants this to be bipartisan. So this, my brother's keeper, in a sense, is making good on that word.
Although he has been criticized, not only on this particular initiative, but on many initiatives, of speaking a great game and yet delivering not that much. And it's hard to really parse exactly how this program is going to significantly help a lot of minority men.
Yeah, and I mean, the members of the CBC I spoke with mentioned that they have not been briefed on the nuts and bolts of how this initiative is going to work and who's responsible. So they're still taking a look at that and seeing how it will go. Many are hopeful that it will have an effect and an impact. And the president said yesterday, this is going to be a long-term thing, hopefully to outlast my presidency. But I find it very interesting that this initiative is not relying on public dollars, which would be very difficult for the president to get, really, for any of his priorities right now through this Congress. Rather, he's turned to philanthropic sectors and the private sector to fund a priority of his. So it really also highlights the partisan gridlock that he's experiencing here in Washington.
Elahe Izadi writes for the National Journal. Thank you for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Well, it only took 4 short years for a young, innocent Justin Bieber to transform into the chaotic, troubled teen star we see in news reports today. I'll talk with a writer who profiled him for Rolling Stone. She says he's really the first pop star to spend his entire career in the social media spotlight. That's coming up on Press Play.
KCRW's Eclectic 24 is our ever-expanding all-music stream featuring the best new releases, classic favorites, and special features, including today's top tune, guest DJ project, and KCRW archives. Listen worldwide anytime online or through your iPhone or Android phone app. KCRW's Eclectic 24, where and when you want it. Check it out at kcrw.com/eclectic24.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. And now let's talk about the Beeb. Justin Bieber. It's been just 4 years, but really an eternity in pop star years between that Justin Bieber and this one. She said it's that press time. Yeah, yeah. I think she might have lied. Feel so good down. Yeah, yeah. And I don't know why I'm addicted. Yeah, yeah. Something like a headache got me. And by now, you've probably heard that Justin Bieber is now cultivating quite the bad boy image.
Hey, you! I got another one for you, actually!
That's Bieber last night hurling eggs at his neighbor's house while cursing him out.
Justin Bieber has a message for Bill Clinton, and we've got the full video.
I guess it is.
This time, he's arrested in Miami for alleged street racing in this yellow Lamborghini, and for drunk driving and resisting arrest.
And 1 week after being charged with driving under the influence in Miami, pop star Justin Bieber is charged with assault this morning in Canada.
He is still really young. I think we forget. He turns 20 years old tomorrow. Claire Hoffman wrote the cover story on Justin Bieber for Rolling Stone magazine, which is on newsstands today, and she's here now to talk about it. Hi, Claire.
Hi, Madeline.
Well, you begin your story with quite the scene. He's in a club in Miami, and his dad is next to him, and he seems wasted, and he's throwing around $75,000 in cash. And it really sets the scene as to what has happened to this cute pop star and in just a short space of time.
It's a real image switch for a lot of people. It's a different Justin Bieber.
Is he doing this on purpose? Does he want to be considered kind of a gangster rapper now, or what?
It's hard to know. I mean, he's certainly giving the world a different view of him than he originally sold 3 or 4 years ago. You know, he built his following with a very, like, squeaky clean Christian, you know, very moralistic, very attitude of gratitude sort of sense of himself. And you know, he sort of flies around on angel's wings in his concerts and kisses girls. And it's very sort of wholesome. And in the last probably 18 months or so, it's really he's really flipped the switch.
And how is he different than any other fallen pop star, a Britney Spears, for example, who tasted success very young and couldn't handle it?
So what I think is so fascinating about Bieber is that he is sort of the DIY, self-made social media star, right? He came up through YouTube. He was discovered that way in his living room, singing to his mom's video camera. His manager, Scooter Braun, discovered him in Canada and built this YouTube and then Facebook and Twitter following very early on and built it into this amazing sort of bubble empire that is very powerful. It's, you know, I mean, he has 50 million followers on Twitter, tens of millions of followers on Facebook. And I mean, just to give you a sense, like 40 million people watch the Oscars and 50 million people are following Justin Bieber when he posts selfies of himself in the bathroom or doing nothing. He has always sort of sold himself on transparency as opposed to Britney Spears, who was a kind of crafted image out of the Disney system. Does that make sense?
Yeah. And is he doing that himself or is it this cultivated transparency, if you will, by his managers and the record label?
It's hard to know. I think he's a smart kid. That would be my guess. And I think he's been, you know, he was the one who got his mom to put it on YouTube, you know, and I think he is sort of best in class in getting attention.
But isn't he just doing what Miley Cyrus is trying to do as well, is recraft an image into something a little more edgy and dangerous and a little more appealing to older people? I don't know.
I mean, I think that's a great point, but I get the feeling that the Miley Cyrus machine is in control. That is a well-crafted media strategy. It is controlled. She is not getting arrested. She's not getting in trouble. You know, she's not assaulting people.
Now, in your story, you quote an author saying that Justin Bieber is just an amplified version of what all teens are experiencing.
Yeah, I think this is sort of the canary in the coal mine point of, if you live a life that is so out there and so based on popularity and sort of so based on being consumed, and it's just all out there. And you can't imagine what that feels like to pick up your phone. I mean, I get stressed out if I pick up my phone and I have three texts. And you imagine Justin Bieber can tweet a picture of him eating an Oreo or, you know, a Cheeto. And he will pick up his phone probably within minutes and see that a million people have said, "God, you look amazing eating that Oreo." And he could probably live his life doing that. He could commodify it. I mean, he has.
Yeah.
I mean, not Oreos specifically.
Right, right. So it's heady at the same time as it's creating this dependency on that public admiration.
Right.
But he does have an interesting origin story. And you go into it a bit in your story in Rolling Stone. And he really came from very humble beginnings.
Extremely humble, very troubled. You know, his mom was a teen mom. She and Patti Millett and Jeremy Bieber were kind of like hard partying teenagers in sort of a working class town in Canada. And they conceived Justin, and his mom, you know, moved to kind of a women's shelter, a Christian women's shelter, found Jesus. Had Justin, you know, when the day that she had Justin, dad was in jail for assault. It was a troubled road from there. You know, they were on government assistance. They were getting help from the church. You know, she was a single mom who just worked a lot of jobs, and she really adored her son. So he really came out of just total anonymity.
And we have an example of what you're talking about. Here is a YouTube clip of him really young. He's singing a Neo song.
And I don't know what to do about it. Even if I did, I don't know if I would quit, but I doubt it. I'm fed up with my thoughts of this.
Oh, so sweet.
You know, you feel it. You feel that he wants it. He wants to be famous. You can hear it.
And so somebody discovered that.
They brought him down to Atlanta. They got him a record deal, I think, within a year.
And how old was he?
He was, I believe, 14.
So that's just 6 years ago.
Yeah.
From then to now.
Yeah.
And then he gets to Atlanta, gets a record deal, and all of a sudden he becomes the superstar of Baby and beyond.
And a phenomenon, like sort of Beatles-esque phenomenon. Like everywhere he goes, there's these sort of stampedes and malls as girls have like waited outside for like 15 days to like touch his body. You know, he can't go anywhere. There's a story about him going to the Beatles' hometown, and he was like a big Beatles fan, and he couldn't even leave his hotel room to go on the tour because like there were so many fans outside.
So you can see how someone who comes from nothing and all of a sudden becomes this worldwide phenomenon at such a tender age just can't handle it.
Yeah, I feel like he is this canary in the coal mine of this sort of coming up out of nothing and being perhaps somewhat unprepared for what that life looks like. And I think the people around him really tried to protect him early on. There was a lot of self-consciousness about that, about protecting him, about having him have a long career, you know, making sure that people were saying no to him, you know, kind of really conscious of what could happen. And I think they thought that could protect them, and it I don't think it did.
Claire Hoffman, her cover story on Justin Bieber is out today in Rolling Stone magazine. Claire, thank you.
My pleasure. Thank you.
If I was your boyfriend, I'd never let you go. I could take you places you ain't never been before. Baby, take a chance or you'll never ever know. I got money in my hands that I really like to blow. Swipe, swipe, swipe.
You want to leave us a comment? 1-844-PRESS-PLAY. Or you can weigh in on our Facebook page, KCRW's Press Play. Sunday is the day Hollywood has been waiting for all year. We look ahead to the Academy Awards in a special edition of our weekly film roundup after this news update with KCRW's Eric Roy.
Listen to KCRW's 24-hour all-news channel. Stream BBC World Service, NPR, and KCRW programs. Continuous coverage and accessible via our smartphone app or online at kcrw.com.
You're listening to Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand, and it's Friday before the big show, the Oscars, on Sunday, which means we are totally blowing out our usual Friday film segment to talk only about that. Kyle Buchanan is here. He's senior editor for New York Magazine's Vulture.com. And John Horn covers the business of Hollywood for the LA Times and is also on KCRW's The Business.
Hello there, Madeline.
All right, so the horse race, it's over, right? Pretty much.
You've seen the voting. You know what's going to happen.
Well, the voting is over.
Yes, the voting concluded this week.
Right. Okay. Yes. So let's talk about that. And I mean, is this a dirty little secret that all Oscar voters don't watch all the movies that they vote for?
Well, you know, it's funny this year because they actually sent the Oscar voters, in addition to the screeners that they normally get of all the big movies, they've opened up all of the categories to the general Oscar population. So the voting body is voting for documentary, for shorts, for foreign language film, these things that used to be restricted to a smaller subcommittee. So they have gotten sent this portfolio of DVDs that's rather immense. And I know that for a lot of Oscar voters, it took up until the very last day for them to submit their votes because they were trying to work their way through as much of it as possible. Whether they got to the end of it is a question.
And there's no way to know, I guess.
There's no way to know, and in some categories you're supposed to attest that you have seen all the nominated films, like in foreign language or documentary. But I talked to a couple Oscar voters over the last couple of days, and a couple of them were voting for movies they hadn't seen. I think it's a little bit like Congress. You know, you hear a bill is good and you think you're going to vote for it, but whether or not you've actually read the text of the bill, no, you haven't.
Mm-hmm. Well, maybe they read your reviews, you guys.
Yeah, well, I mean, certainly the sort of sentiment or the buzz can help. You want to back a front runner even if you haven't seen it. Don't throw your vote away.
I think there's also a real issue whether or not people, and I think it's specific to one film, and it's 12 Years a Slave, mm-hmm. people are still, to this point, you know, worried about how difficult a film it is. And they don't want to watch it because they know it's going to be upsetting. They know it's going to be harsh. They know it's going to be grim. And I talked to two Oscar voters in the last week, both of whom said they were going to vote for it for Best Picture, even though they hadn't seen the film.
That's crazy.
Wow, wow. Well, what about the Bradley effect? And this is something that happens in political polling where pollsters will ask people if there's a minority candidate in the race, who do you plan to vote for? And they say, oh, yes, I'll vote for that candidate. And in fact, they don't once they get into the privacy of the voting booth.
Well, you know, the Oscar ballot is set up in this way. It's called the preferential ballot, and it gets very mathy if I try to explain it. But fundamentally, you rank all of the movies from 1 to 9, and the number one votes are important, but the number 2 and 3 votes are important too, especially those number 2s. And so there has been sort of, I've seen a lot of consensus from the pundits that Gravity and American Hustle are going to benefit from being sort of a number two, a safe number two pick. I actually think that 12 Years a Slave, which I should proceed by saying is an incredibly worthy movie, definitely deserves a lot of number ones and will get them, will end up getting a lot of those number twos just because a lot of the voters will think, what does it say about me that I would put a movie like this lower? You know, it feels like perhaps there's a voter who preferred Philomena more, but 12 Years a Slave has got to be up there.
Yeah,
but,
and I think the way
private,
the voting
though,
is...
right? I mean, no one has to know how you voted, so you could just vote what you really like the most.
Yes, but how does that reflect on you?
Yeah, but I'd also think that if a movie has a huge number of supporters and a huge number of detractors, I can think of Social Network, Zero Dark Thirty being films like that, it tends to hurt them. As Kyle explained, the voting benefits movies that have consensus appeal. And I think that's going to help not just 12 Years a Slave, but American Hustle and Gravity. And I think that's why we have such a close race this year.
Okay, let's take a listen to a clip from this movie.
I don't like change. It's really hard for me. Sometimes I think that I'll die before I change.
That movie is...
Jennifer Lawrence in American Hustle.
Very good, very good. So it got so much buzz, and yet I feel like now there's kind of a meh feeling about it.
Yeah, you know, there was a moment in early January where it looked like American Hustle was the one to beat all of a sudden. It had really surged. And then there was the Producers Guild Awards, which tend to be the precursor that, you know, has the best track record of producing the Best Picture winner. And there was a shock tie win between Gravity and 12 Years a Slave. Not just shocking because it was a tie, not just shocking because it was those two movies, but shocking because it essentially means that American Hustle was number three at best. So after that, even though it scored pretty well at the BAFTAs this past week, a little bit of hope deflated from that balloon.
Right, right.
Yeah, but I also think something else happens when that occurs, and that is that people start voting for a movie not in a category in which they think it should win, but they start voting in a way in which a movie will win. In other words, with American Hustle, I think people would say, I really like the movie. I like David O. Russell. I don't see it winning Best Picture. So maybe I'll cast my vote for Jennifer Lawrence for supporting actress, where she might beat Lupita Nyong'o from 12 Years a Slave, or maybe I'll vote it for original screenplay. So people start voting for a film in a category just to kind of give it a win, to give it recognition. I think that's happened a lot this year based on the conversations I've had with Oscar voters.
Okay, let's talk about the show itself. Mm-hmm. And here's a little clip from last year's awards.
Playing a woman who spends almost 12 years tracking Osama bin Laden. 12 years. The film was a triumph and also a celebration of every woman's innate ability to never, ever let anything go. Well, we have finally reached the point in the ceremony where either Javier Bardem, Penelope Cruz, or Salma Hayek comes on stage, and we have no idea what they're saying, but we don't care because they're so attractive.
Ugh, Seth MacFarlane. And you're out.
Exactly.
Thank goodness. So what do you think? Obviously, Ellen DeGeneres is no Seth MacFarlane.
No, she's not. The Academy tends to whiplash between the out-of-the-box host and the safe, overcompensating one, and I think we're going to get the latter this year. If they could just find a happy medium, then maybe people wouldn't, you know, have so much to complain about. But I'm sure that no matter how Ellen does, and I'm sure I expect her to do a very smooth job hosting it, she'll be attacked for being too safe. You know, people just aren't happy with
the
show. No,
they're never happy, though,
are
they?
Well, there's always room for improvement. I'm sure that John can speak to it, too. But, you know, there are things. I myself would cut all of the shorts categories. I think that would be a great change and would help the ceremony come in a lot faster. I don't think we really need the shorts in the era of YouTube when shorts don't play in front of movies anymore.
Kyle, that car on fire in front of KCRW, that's your car that has just been set afire by all of these short filmmakers who don't get any glory outside of the Oscar night. Mm-hmm. I agree, if you could cut some categories, sound effects, you start looking at the category, they have constituencies and they certainly never get in the spotlight. You know, there's the boilerplate of you have to do the necrology of everybody who's died. My solution is as soon as somebody mentions my team, if they mention their talent agents, their publicists, there's a trapdoor, they fall through the stage and they're never seen from again. Or they're given a mild electric shock, kind of like the South Park movie. That's where I would start.
But they should maybe have to audition their thank you speeches first.
Absolutely. I mean, these are people who are in theory at the top of their craft. And I know just because you're an actor doesn't necessarily make you a great public speaker. But when people say, I haven't prepared anything, come on, prepare something and make it interesting, make it emotional, make it personal, and don't start thanking your team at CIA because nobody cares
and
outside
the fact,
your team at CIA.
The fact is they have had all of award season to prepare because they've been making speeches at other award shows.
Right.
Obviously, this is the big kahuna of award shows, but there's got to be like a little bit a little bit in your head already about, okay, this is how it goes. This is typically how long I have up there. You know that stuff. Work to it.
Right, right. Here's my radical suggestion. Cut the musical numbers.
Okay. I understand that radical suggestion. However, I just find the musical numbers always are like a little bit strange and odd, and they give people something to talk about. This year in particular, we've got great songs nominated. We have Let It Go. We have Happy. We have the U2 song. So I'm sort of curious to see those performed. Thank goodness last year we had Adele singing, you know.
Yeah.
I'd rather have that than a montage about superheroes or a tribute to Chicago or things of that nature.
And the real issue too is even the best musical number within the Academy Awards is never going to compete with the best musical number at the Grammys. I mean, the Grammys music, live music performances are always going to be better. The Tonys, you can stage something theatrically. Movies by their nature are kind of, they're not performance based in a live setting. So you can't get around the fact that movies are watched in a theater with a group of people, and you can't turn them into a performance for a television ceremony.
Although I do hear that Pink is going to be there, so there might be some flying trapeze situation.
And Bette Midler. Yeah, there might be, or maybe they'll just team up and sing the In Memoriam song. So
we'll see. Okay, well, there's another awards show this weekend, the Independent Spirit Awards, mm-hmm. and that's happening on Saturday. Do people pay attention to these? Are they really that independent? Are they spirited?
The definition of what is an independent film versus what is a studio film is completely blurred now. You have Best Picture nominations like Her, American Hustle, that were financed by Megan Ellison, who's got more money than God. Well, more money except everybody than her father, Larry Ellison. So that's an independent movie in terms of it being made outside the studio system. 12 Years a Slave is the leading contender at the Independent Spirit Awards. It's a $22 million movie. Is that really independent? I don't know. Nebraska, Alexander Payne's movie, a $12 million movie. Yes, it was kind of financed outside the studio system, but not really. So I think those lines are very blurry right now.
Yeah, that's become very elastic. It used to be that $20 million was supposed to be the tipping point, and past that, you didn't qualify for the Indie Spirits. But last year, Silver Linings Playbook made it in somehow. Who knows how? You know, maybe they had a very influential producer or something that helped grease the wheels there. And, of course, won just about everything it could. You know, there's a certain, though the Indie Spirits, I do appreciate them and they're great. I'm going tomorrow. And they do recognize they have a lot of left field nominees that would never, ever make it into any other award show. I do kind of wish that ultimately it didn't feel like they were trying to ape the Oscars.
Yeah.
I want them to be their own self, their own defiant, unique, independent self.
All right, you guys, I think maybe one last question, and that is there one topic that you'll be so grateful you'll never have to talk about again after Sunday night?
I will be very happy to never see another headline about, will this Woody Allen imbroglio hurt Cate Blanchett's Oscar chances? If we can put that one to bed, no one will miss it.
John?
Yeah, and I think I am not looking forward to hearing any more stories about how much weight Matthew McConaughey and Jared Leto lost for Dallas Buyers Club. Great performances, but let's move on.
I need something, will you? Okay. John Horn covers the business of Hollywood for the LA Times and is also a contributor to KCRW's The Business. And Kyle Buchanan writes about movies for New York Magazine. Thanks, you guys.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And right after you eat something, you can tune in to Warren Olney's show.
You can indeed. And this is one of those subjects that we would probably rather not talk about, but we're stuck with it. And that is this. After President Obama was elected, a lot of people thought we were going to have a post-racial society and that the millennium generation would lead the way. Well, it turns out that's not the case. And in fact, on college campuses all over the country, there have been racially charged incidents. And it's very interesting to consider those from the standpoint of whether they're really racism or not. What about the question of intent? Do kids really understand what they're doing when they're in fact being insensitive and making people of color not feel comfortable? And all of this, of course, in the context of the reduction of affirmative action so that there are fewer students of color on campuses. It's a very charged situation. It's very interesting and
very
important.
Fascinating discussion up ahead at 1 o'clock on To the Point with Warren Olney. Thank you. And on this show, one of the movies up for an Oscar in the foreign language category is the Palestinian movie Omar. It has the same subject matter as an Israeli feature film called Bethlehem, which is in theaters now. So we find out how both directors tackle the same plot line very differently, as you can imagine. That's next on Press Play.
Do you like KCRW on Facebook? If not, you're missing out on the latest music updates, program exclusives, and in-studio video clips. Join the conversation at facebook.com/KCRW.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. The Israeli movie Bethlehem is in theaters now, and the Palestinian film Omar will be out next week. They're both highly regarded. Bethlehem was shortlisted for the Best Foreign Language Oscar this year, and Omar was actually nominated. And they have more in common than that. Both stories center around an Israeli intelligence officer and his relationship with a Palestinian informant. Press Play producer Matt Holzman, who's also host of KCRW's First Take screening series, thought that talking to the two directors would offer some unique insight into how Israelis and Palestinians view each other. Hi, Matt.
Hello, Madeline.
So first, I have to ask, did the filmmakers know about each other's movies?
Well, according to them, they didn't. And they have no reason to not tell the truth. But I have to say, it's odd because obviously the subject matter is quite similar. Yeah. And in fact, in one of the movies, the Israeli agent is named Rami, and in the other one, he's Razi. And that the last scene, and I don't want to give anything away, but the last scene really ends on a very, very similar note.
And throughout the movie, are they similar?
Well, you know, in some ways they are. I mean, but in Omar, in the Palestinian film, it centers around a love triangle, and it has a lot of action. In Bethlehem, it's all about them trying to catch a terrorist, using the informant to catch a terrorist. But they both explore this really complicated relationship between the handler and the informant. And Yuval Adler, the Israeli director of Bethlehem, uses the term instead of informant, asset.
To run assets is fundamentally to be their shrink, their father, and to develop a human relationship that at the same time is the most exploitative relationship you can imagine.
So I'm guessing, Matt, that that relationship looks very different in the Palestinian film.
Yes. I mean, they're similar, except for in Omar, the asset, the title character Omar, is definitely a victim. He's the protagonist. You root for him. In the Israeli film, Bethlehem, nobody comes out looking very good. None of the sides is particularly sympathetic. And you get the feeling that the Israeli film is trying to be, you know, quote unquote, balanced, to see things through all the characters. In fact, Yuval Adler wrote the script with an Arab Israeli journalist named Ali Wakat, and they spent 3 years researching the film.
We talked to Palestinian militants from Hamas and Al-Aqsa Brigades, many of them. They have no problem talking to you when you tell them you're making a film. We talked to people who were informants. We talked to Secret Service guys. Took us the longest to get to talk, to really sit down with these people.
And what about the Palestinian film, Omar? Was it also mixed in terms of the cast and crew?
No, not at all. This is how the director, Haini Abu Asad, explained it to me.
I made Omar with our own investors and cast and crew. If I was normal American or normal European or normal Jordanese, I won't be so proud. But because I'm part of really a nation that seeking to be equal and free as anybody else. And by doing a movie independently, you feel you are a step forward toward independence.
So you see, even before you get to the content of the films, like where the films are coming from reveals this kind of schism in a point of view. But what's interesting is that both filmmakers are middle class, highly educated. They both studied and lived extensively abroad. And they probably have more in common than they have differences. And yet they see the world differently because of these different experiences.
So when you compare the two and how they handle this, it seems from what you've just told me that the Israeli filmmaker is trying to be a little more even-handed. Maybe it's easier for him to be more even-handed.
But you could say he has the luxury to do that.
Yeah. And the Palestinian filmmaker didn't feel like he had that luxury to do that.
But it's even more complicated than that, because Yuval Adler, the Israeli director, wouldn't talk to me at all about the Palestinian movie. He just said, I'm too close to it. And I think that's kind of telling, maybe in some way. There's no upside for him being critical of Omar. But Hani Abu Asad was really happy to talk about Bethlehem. And if you listen carefully to what he says, he doesn't think that the film is all that even-handed.
When I watched the movie, I truly appreciate it because even though I didn't like the politics of it, but so what? I mean, it's a good movie, and it's, it really gave me an opportunity to understand the Israeli side, which is good. I mean, this is why we should do movies and appreciate movies.
So you said, though, that nobody comes out looking very good in the Israeli movie Bethlehem.
Yeah, so it's interesting. So I think in one way, Haney is saying it is balanced because I got to see the Israeli point of view. But on the other side, he still thinks it reeks of the politics of the inequity of the situation, and that the movie, even though it's about the futility of the situation, still makes the Israelis look good. And I think that this is really kind of an example of the subtle complexity of the attitudes between Israelis and Palestinians and why it's so hard when the two of them try to talk to each other. Listen to how Yuval Adler, who directed Bethlehem, the Israeli film, describes the main bad guy in his film, Badawi.
Badawi is like, you know, he's a violent character, but he's kind of, for me, is the most authentic, the most uncompromised character in the film. We made him, you know, as heroic as we can, the way he would perceive himself.
Okay, so now listen to what Haney, who directed the Palestinian film, says about that.
If you analyze it in the storytelling, the Israelis are the heroes and the Palestinians are the bad guys, because bad guys in any movie are unpredictable. The antagonists have no reason, they have no motivation and can flip any second, and the hero always have a kind of reason, even he make a mistake.
So when he says flip, he means to commit a violent act unpredictably.
Right. And so he's saying in his movie, the Israelis, when they do violent things, they have good motivation. Everybody has good motivation in his movie. In Bethlehem, he's saying that the Palestinians almost, they rarely have good motivation. It's just because they're crazy. And that is a prototypical kind of movie trope, that the good guys always have good motivation, even when they do bad things. And the bad guys always just act completely irrationally because they're mad.
Yeah, and even in that earlier clip that you played from Yuval Adler, he describes the character as violent.
Right. But probably the most revealing thing I asked both directors was, I said, if there was a suicide bombing in Israel, would that have affected people going to your movie? And here's what the Israeli Yuval Adler said.
It was the number one movie of last year, which is remarkable because it's not, you know, a light-hearted comedy, you know, to say the least. We were describing, you know, the post-intifada 2005. A few years went by. It was quiet and people could stomach the film. And I'm sure that if there's something would start, they would just not go. I'm sure we would have, you know, one-tenth of the audience.
So Yuval Adler is saying if there had been some kind of violent activity in Israel, people wouldn't have gone to see his film. But on the flip side, Haney said about his film, the Palestinian film, that had there been, say, a suicide bomb or an increase in violence between Israelis and Palestinians, that would not have affected whether people saw his film Omar or not. And he said, in fact, he didn't think it should affect it.
When we were watching The Sopranos, yes, all over, and every day there was criminal killing. So you stop watching The Sopranos? I never heard of one person after watching The Godfather came to me and said, you know what, crime is good. No one. There is no one.
Okay, so Matt, how did the audiences react to these two movies?
In Israel, Bethlehem, the Israeli film, seemed very much like a Rorschach test. Yuval said that, the director said, his movie was number one at the box office. But the part that some Israelis had a problem with was a very powerful scene where a Palestinian suicide bomber is being mourned by his father.
And he cries over the body of his son. And some came to me and said, how can you? This is the most, all the emotions, you show emotions there. And this guy is a terrorist, you know. But some Israeli Arabs said, you show the Secret Service as too human.
So you kind of saw in the film what mm-hmm. you brought to it. The flip side is that Haney, who made his film for Palestinians, and he told them that the Palestinians who had seen it in Israel, because people in Israel did, and in the territories, really liked it, whether they were people on the street or whether they were kind of the elite, like he admits himself to being of. Ironically, he said that the Palestinian audiences were harder to get into the theater to see his movie and then harder to please with the movie itself.
Most of the Palestinians don't watch Palestinian movies because they prefer to watch, you know, entertaining movies from Hollywood, from Bollywood, from Turkey. And I felt like, you know what, if I succeed to convince Palestinians of the truth of the story, and I can engage them. I think I can engage anybody in this world because they are the most difficult to engage because they know the story better than you and me.
All right. So Bethlehem comes out next weekend. Omar already in theaters and up for an Academy Award this weekend.
And both great movies. And what'll be interesting to see is whether the kind of Israeli-Arab conflict plays out in the battle over Oscar for foreign film and whether Oscar voters can separate themselves from the politics of the region and just look at Omar as a film, a very, very good film. And I guess we'll find out on Sunday.
Matt Holzman, thank you.
Right on.
All right, Jolie Myers is here now with the Mail. Hi.
Hi, Madeline. Yesterday, we talked about the history of Jesus movies, keeping with our movie theme of the last half of the show. Well, listener Glenn Habas took to our Facebook page just outraged that we forgot this movie.
Yay, yay, so you say. The one who sits amongst us has already betrayed me this night.
Who?
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 Who can it be?
Judas! Do you want a beverage? Try the mulled wine. It's terrific.
No! Leave us alone!
That, of course, is from Mel Brooks's The History of the World, Part 1. So there you go, Glenn. It's been on the show now. Elsewhere in the pop culture world, we covered Justin Bieber earlier in the show, and I think this is Press Play's greatest sorry, not sorry moment. but Zell called in, and he left us a message.
I am really disappointed that I just had to listen to that story about Justin Bieber. I usually think of KCRW as a sanctuary from those kinds of stories, but I guess not. Maybe if it hadn't come right after a story about collecting water in buckets, I'd be more charitable towards it. But not something I hope to have to hear again.
Well, Zell, we probably won't do it again because we just did it on today's show, so you're safe. We never get hate mail when we cover schlocky movies or reality TV. I don't know what it is about music that makes people so salty, but
well, I think it's the pop culture part of it, you know, the sort of In Touch magazine part of it.
Right.
But it really wasn't about that. It was more sort of more, well, we know what it was about. Anyway.
We heard it, but yes. We're not going to hear it again. So, Zell, there you go.
All right. Jolie Myers, thank you very much.
No problem.
All right. That'll do it for us today. If you want to contact us, you certainly can. Leave us a voicemail, 844-PRESS-PLAY. Email pressplay@kcrw.com. We're on Twitter. We're on Facebook. We are everywhere, except we're not here anymore because it's the end of the show. Have a great weekend, everyone. I'm Madeline Brand. I'll see you on Monday.